Hello and welcome to The Future is Spoken, produced by the Digital Assistant Academy. This show accompanies the Digital Assistant Academy's course entitled Voice Interaction Design. Have you ever wondered how is designing a voice experience is different for kids than any other audiences? From regulations to interactions, there are a lot of things to consider. In today's episode, Shyamala Praga speaks with Matthew Hammersley about voice design strategy for kids. Matthew Hammersley is the founder and CEO of The Novel Effect, which uses voice recognition combined with sound effects to enhance story time for parents, teachers, and children. Matt was previously a patent attorney for various companies. During his daughter's baby shower function, an idea for bringing new technology like voice recognition to the timeless tradition of reading aloud to children and making storytelling more engaging came to his mind. That is when he quit his job to start the company Novel Effect. Matt comes from a chemical engineering background from Clemson University. Enjoy the show.
Welcome to another episode of The Future is Spoken. Today we are going to talk about designing for kids and the voice strategies which we have to consider, especially when designing for kids. And I have a very special guest with me today, Matthew Hammersley, CEO of Novel Effect Inclusive with us.
Thank you very much and really appreciate being here.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Matt. We are really excited to have you today and talk about voice design strategy for kids. So before we jump into the episode, could you tell us a little bit about yourself, your background?
Sure. I have a very kind of atypical background. I actually got my undergrad degree in chemical engineering and then did some cryptography for the Department of Defense and then went on into patent law and practiced intellectual property and patent law for about 10 years before starting this company where we make reading magical for kids and grownups. So it's quite a shift and change throughout my career.
Right. Yeah. You have an incredible journey from starting your career as a patent officer and now doing voice design. It's a completely different shift now. Now you are designing applications for entertainment and storytelling and those kind of things for kids, right? So could you tell us a little bit about that? How was that journey with you?
Yeah, well, for me, it's all about kids. And that's kind of why we started this company, why we invented what we did, was we wanted to bring to the world something that we as parents could share together with our kids and make the world a better place. As fun as patent law is, I was writing patents for big companies and corporations, and it just didn't get the personal feel and love and enjoyment that I do today. And so it's been a journey to get here, but one that I couldn't be more excited about.
So what was that one thing you wished you knew when you started this?
Oh my gosh, that list is really long. So there definitely was not one thing, but many. I would say the biggest lesson was knowing when to stop something, right? It's always hard to say no to things, whether that be a new opportunity or kind of a product idea. But the quicker you can say no to the things that aren't going to be meaningful to your business, the less resources and time that you will waste. And so getting to that no as quickly as you can with as least amount of resources expended is something that I think we've continually gotten better at, but something I wish I would have known kind of at the outset.
Cool. So could you tell us a little bit about Novel Effect as well? What do you do there? And I know you have like cool products and I'm sure listeners would love to know more.
Yeah. So what we do at Novel Effect is voice interactive storytelling. And our core products augment kind of the traditional content verticals of books, videos, and games to add this layer of voice interactivity to make these experiences immersive and magical for kids and their grownups. So our core first product that we came to market with was our voice interactive books. And those listen to you read aloud a book with your child and synchronizes music, sound effects, characters' voices, all in real time with you, the parent or teacher, reading aloud. So the whole purpose is to make it reading magical for kids and their grownups.
How did this idea come to your mind? It's really fascinating. Just thinking about a story, like I still remember when I used to read stories to my son, it was very straightforward. I'll try to just give it a little bit of emotions and all of those things. But you went one step ahead with all of these things, like giving the emotions, the background music, and those different effects, which will actually make kids feel like they are part of that story. And it's all voiceover, right? Like where teachers can read it loud, or kids can read it loud, or taking turns, or things like that. So how did this idea come to your mind?
Yeah, well, the initial idea actually came at a baby shower for my daughter before she was born. We asked all of our guests to bring us books instead of cards so we could start building a little library for her. And one of my wife's friends started reading aloud the book that she brought. And she added in all these fun voices and sound effects and essentially captivated a room of adults and kids as she was reading us this story. So I had done patent work in the voice space, and it was kind of a light bulb moment of, oh my gosh, if every parent and teacher could tell a story like that, all kids would love to read. I couldn't let it go. I was up that night doing patent searches, seeing what else is out there, bothering my wife, who was 7 to 8 months pregnant, and telling her we could do this, we could do that, kind of unlocked a whole flood of ideas. And so, yeah, 3 months later, we had both quit our jobs, sold our house, had our daughter, moved across the country, and started the company.
Wow, too many things. I mean, actually, you took that leap of faith. I think not many people would do that. But then it's amazing, like just from an event, how you got the idea. It's a fascinating story, really. And you know what it is today. I know there's a lot of adoption, especially for that product. And schools are also using it. You're also trying to bring it into different industries as well. So which is really fascinating. So Matt, tell us one thing, that especially because this is a product which is for kids. So when we are designing for kids, what are the kind of challenges you faced or one would face when they are designing something similar?
Yeah, and there's a lot. Kids' voice is, it's really hard. There's no other way to say it, just because it's different than what you would expect an adult to do. And all of kind of the prior learnings and systems that are built and put into place are for adults. And then you add in kind of the legal challenges to get the right data to train kind of these voice systems to be good, really have impediments into being successful. A couple of things that we kind of focused on and make us rather unique. We're not actually designing just for kids. We're designing for families. We're designing for classrooms. So our product has to work for both instantly. It's got to work for the kid. It's got to work for a non-native speaker. It's got to work for adults, teachers, grandparents. And so we really took it as, well, how do we have to reinvent kind of the voice stack in order to accommodate for this? Because the data is not there. The models are not there to a point that you could have robust success on voice all across the different voice types that you have. So what we did that was very different than pretty much I think anybody else is we are not a conversational interface. It is not an intent-based reasoning and rationale. And we don't have to kind of decipher and understand every single word in a language and the intent behind those words on every interaction and utterance. We took a step back and said, well, if we want this really robust, flexible system, we're going to have to change the way kind of the typical voice profile is set up and focus on what makes us unique. We have a very predefined story and text, right? And we use that kind of to make the voice models more robust and flexible across all of these different voice types. So that was our big thing that we changed and that we found that the intent-based systems just aren't there yet. They're just not good enough. And we had to do something different in order to have success. And I'm proud to say that our technology works for a four-year-old. So
that's amazing. I still remember when we were doing beta testing for Alexa and I brought that small dot at home. And my son, who was 3 at that time, would try attempt to talk to her and Alexa would not understand most of the things, and how patiently my son would be like, Alexa, play music, Alexa, and he would just continue repeating the same thing over and over. Like, we would get frustrated at some point and we'll be like, okay, that's it, and we start yelling at it. So did you see like such kind of differences when you're designing for kids? They have a different mental model with how they interact with the system, how they behave with the system, or any such things?
Yeah, I mean, again, we're not doing as much of the intent, so we didn't go too far down that pathway. But I'm also have a 5-year-old and a 2-year-old now, and we were a very early adopter of Alexa and experienced the exact same things that you refer to. It's different how kids perceive the world and how they perceive these voice assistants. Because my daughter, for example, she's never known anything but. It's always been in her house. And so she kind of has a comfort level with it that maybe adults don't have. And she gets really excited when Alexa does recognize her correctly and does what mm-hmm. she asks. So I think they do have more patience to try and try again, whereas we as adults would give up pretty quickly, right? I think in what happened with Alexa and these systems, when they hit, I think it was 83%-ish efficacy, that's when they really started to take off because it was more convenient and less frustrating than more frustrating. So I think kids don't have that kind of threshold. It's much lower. And I think they have an expectation that Alexa is way smarter than she actually is.
Well, yeah, it could solve their homework. My son was attempting to do that, especially with math, like all complex stuffs. And he would try to ask him, don't try that. Don't try to get the answers from the bot. Because I scared sometimes that maybe that would affect their ability to do the calculations or mathematical things, which we were taught, like the formulas or the logics or the basics. So I'm really curious to know, like when we are designing for kids, especially where is the balance with these kind of things where we can say like, these are some things which is good because this will teach the kids some sort of manners or this will entertain them versus this is the boundary beyond which if we design something, it may impact us in the long run.
Yeah. And it's something I'm pretty sensitive to because, excuse me, the last thing I want is my daughter to have a great relationship with Alexa. It's just not a goal of mine. My goal is that we have a great relationship together and that she's a good member of our household and the community. And I think there's a challenge there as far as how we think about use, how we think about what skills or actions or experiences are developed with these systems. I think the onus is honestly, it's on the parent, right? To guard and track that just like they would with what they look at on the internet, right? It's just another system that I think we can't abdicate our responsibility as parents to these devices and to these systems. But what works at the end of the day will rise to the top, right? And I think we're at the very early innings as to seeing what kind of those modalities of interactions are and kind of what maybe some of the long-term behavioral implications are. But I know what we do at our household, which is we use manners with Alexa. We say please, we say thank you, right? As one example, when she does schoolwork, and she's only in kindergarten, but she is not, like you said, allowed to ask kind of for the answers, has to figure it out herself, and then she can get confirmation that it is correct from those systems. So that's how we approach it kind of in the household for ourselves. And I think there's a lot of parents that will do things similarly.
So is it like something which parents have to think on their end, like this is what we should be controlling? Or do you think, is there some strategy companies need to also consider when they are designing like any voice application or skills?
Well, I think it's both. It's definitely both. Coming from the developer side, I think you want your users to have a successful experience. Whatever that kind of goal is for your application, you want them to have success at it. And so thinking about what that means, what success means kind of in the content of your application and really optimizing the experience for that metric and outcome is how I would think about it. And it's just important to really define up front kind of with kids in play, what do I want the end outcomes to be here?
That's interesting. So you mentioned use cases as well, right? And previously when we spoke, you did speak about the legalities and stuff like that as well. So basically, when any voice assistant is launched for recording purposes or any such purposes, for training purposes and improving the system, we collect a lot of data about everyone, including kids, right? And then it could be their voice, maybe for recognition purposes, like who this person is, or it could be just their voice for the utterances to then process it and then know, how to improve the system back. So what kind of challenges, like data challenges or privacy challenges, one should consider when thinking about collection of data, especially for kids?
Yeah, it's super important. And we are a privacy first company here. I can tell you what we did as an approach to our voice application. And it's basically not to record anything, not to store anything. We operate locally on the device and not through the cloud. So we don't require, right, recording and transmission in order to operate our system. So first and foremost, we designed ours locally from the get-go. And we did that with privacy in mind. So I think recognizing that there are two pathways between localized and cloud. And if you're designing for kids, I think you need to do everything you can to be localized, if you can be. If you can't, from like technical constraints or whatever, and you have to be cloud, then you're kind of locked into what Amazon and Google do if you're building an action or a skill. You don't really have much choice in the matter, and they will do what they do, and you kind of have to just abide by it. So there's really no options there. It's whatever they set as the bar, you have to follow. When you talk about third-party systems and us, we have our own voice tech and our own voice stack kind of from end to end. And so when you go cloud, only use it for what you absolutely have to, right? As far as running the experience, and don't save things just because they could be beneficial to you in the future, right? If you don't have a explicit direct need for that material, delete it and give your users agency over their data. Like, give them control. Don't hide the ball. Put it up front as to what you are going to be doing with this data, and act honorably, because I think your users will judge you for it.
So this is an interesting point. And this also, like when we say designing for kids, what is the age bracket we are looking at? What age would we say that, okay, you are self-sufficient to do your own stuffs?
13.
13. So that's interesting. So after 13, do kids have control over things? I was recently reading a Facebook post where, I think the kid was purchasing something or something was there, and the parent was actually trying to get access to his history, but then he logged it out. And by law, she was not supposed to actually look at any of those things without his consent.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And it happens with our medical data as well. I think it was something to do with shopping or something to do with medical. I don't remember exactly. But then it's the same with our medical data as well. Right. If something happens, I have to give a written consent to the hospital saying I want my husband to have access to all of my medical history and all of those things. So this kid actually like sued their parents for that reason.
I'm not that familiar with that specific case, but yeah, I mean, informed consent is a big deal, and it applies in multiple ways. Being a lawyer myself, HIPAA and COPPA are very different. They may have some overlaps, right, in kind of fundamental principles, but, the laws are there to protect kids and to protect companies from taking advantage of kids and not selling kids' data and advertising to kids. Like, that's the goal of these applications. It's not to prevent you from creating things for kids and having fun experiences for kids, but it's that you treat them the right way. So I think in the example that you referenced, it is very interesting that these systems get put into place, right, with these rules and constructions, and you get some weird results sometimes that doesn't seem like it should be that way, but it's trying to safeguard a user privacy. And I think if you're doing that, that's probably a good thing, right, versus the other way.
Yeah, it's interesting how things can go complicated, especially when designing such things. You mentioned HIPAA and COPPA. What kind of things are like part of the Children Protection Act? Is it like the voice biometrics or just the data or recordings or everything?
Yeah, well, I mean, at a fundamental level, COPPA says if it's kind of a little bit complicated, but just to give a brief summary of what COPPA is, you cannot collect, record, store any information from a child if they're a child, or if your product is geared directly to a child. So if you're a general audience product that includes kids, but you don't know their age, right, COPPA doesn't apply. If you're a general audience product, but you do know their age, well, then you can't record, store, or transmit any personally identifiable information of that child without informed parental consent. So again, all of these safeguards and these rules are just built to say, hey, you can send the data in these circumstances, and then not, you need to go ask a parent or a caregiver, right? You need informed consent from an adult in order to collect, record, store, transmit any of this personally identifiable information of a child.
So the same thing applies to maybe Amazon, or the same thing applies to Google Assistant as well. Like, they are more of a general, but there are certain things which, you know, everyone can access. For example, kids, they will do everything because they keep hearing what we are doing. Mm-hmm. And now they could ask the same kind of thing. There were news, like when Alexa was initially launched, there was this kid who actually bought 100 gingerbread houses. Like, obviously kids don't talk in like 1, 2, 3s. They talk in millions and hundreds and thousands. Randomly, anything my son would say, 79 something. I'm like, I don't know, where do you get that number from? Right? So then this is what happened, that this kid actually bought a lot of gingerbread houses, and eventually parents were unaware of this thing. And when it arrived, everyone was at shock. And then when they looked at the purchase history, it was done by a kid. Now, how, if you are designing a generalized product, some of the things could be not like relevant to kids, or you don't want them to have access to. So what kind of measures designers should take in order to protect those kind of things, so the kids are not using it?
Or I think the biggest thing is that you have, you know, family profiles, and that you give the parents agency here, because that's where it always comes in, right? The parent was surprised. They didn't think this was possible. They didn't think that could happen. So designing where you have a parent profile and a child profile, and you proactively gate from things that you don't want the kid to experience, or you give the parent the agency to gate it themselves. I think that is the first thing that you can do if you're a general audience product, really giving the parent the agency and control.
So how would the system know that it is a kid or it is a parent who's accessing the system? Like, not every system out there have biometrics or some sort of authentication system, right? So for example, I did not set any profile, and if my son asks Alexa, it would just respond back. Sometimes if he says something like, what is my name? It would come back saying Shamla, mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah, well, I mean, you got to remember here, the difference is that in the Alexa and the Google environments, you're getting informed parental consent, or at least what they say is informed parental consent. So you're agreeing to it in your terms of service that your kid uses the product, right? All of that is already there. And if you get something that they target specifically for kids, like the special Echo Dots for kids, right, you have to go through some more extra hoops as a parent when you set that up, so that they can get that informed parental consent and thereby record, store, transmit, and do things, right, specific to your child. So they probably don't want to know necessarily that it's a kid talking, I think the tech is pretty good these days guessing an age of a voice. It's probably plus or minus 3 years, I would say, is how well that works these days. But I'm not aware that they actually implement any of those features today as far as authentication or gating.
That was my point. So without authentication, how would these profiles actually work?
Yeah, well, I mean, if you've ever done it before in the Amazon app, like, you have to set it up, and you as the parent, you tell them. It's just like when you go onto a website. I mean, if you go onto a website or something like that has an age gate, well, it depends on the user response, and you take the user response at face value. That is how typical authentication in digital works. And I don't think this would be any different.
Got it. So switching the gears a little bit, we spoke about privacy, which is like an interesting and fascinating topic for me always. Now let's talk about when you were designing your product, where kids are listening to the stories and all of these different effects were there, where they were maybe if it was night and there was an animal, maybe there was a sound of an animal and things like that, right? How did you test out the experience that this is something kids are enjoying and this is how they are feeling engaged with the story?
Yeah, we kind of never forget the first couple of times that we did it, right? We created one, we did half of one book. It was The Little Engine That Could. And we just did tests with families and friends first, right? That's how we got started. And we kind of knew we had something immediately because the kids were just basically jaw dropped in amazement and wonder throughout this whole story. And the parents looking at us like, they can't sit still for a story. How did you do that? Right. So we really took our cues early on. And I think real live testing, right, is the only way that you get kind of the meaningful feedback that you want. You got to do it often and do it continuously and listen kind of to that feedback, both the overt things that they tell you, right, as well as kind of the things that they just naturally do and that you observe. So that's what we did, and we continue to do it today. And we rely very heavily on kind of user feedback. That's why I think we have a 4.9 App Store rating, is largely because we listen to that feedback and we have iterated and we continue to iterate to ensure that we're providing it to the kids and we're providing it to the families.
That's interesting. Yeah, I tried that with my son also. Like, we played some of the stories and he was like thoroughly enjoying that. So when you did that, did you have a focus in mind? Like, these are my target audiences, like especially who's listening to the story, like this is the age group which they will cater to. Because as kids grow, they have a different choice. And the kindergartner or maybe 3-year-old, 2-year-old may enjoy some of those things more than maybe 11, 12-year-old, right? Mm-hmm. How do you balance that experience?
Yeah, well, I mean, for us, the complexity of the music and sound effects and interactions that we design scales directly with the content itself, right? So if it is a small board book for 2-year-olds, 3-year-olds, it's kind of simple sound design that really connects and engages on a very clear way. As we get more into the like picture books for 8 to 10-year-olds for us, the sound design becomes much more complex, right? The music and intonations and kind of the underlying themes throughout that audio experience is progressively more complex. And this is also what makes it so much fun for the parents and the adults, right? Is that kind of level of complexity and realizing that when you're designing for kids and particularly for families, like you don't leave the adults out. Like this is why Disney has a lot of adult-oriented jokes inside of their movies because they want to make it fun for the parents too. And so we kind of take that approach and that philosophy and how we design kind of our content. But I think you do have to look specifically at who is the target audience here. For us, since we pair with these existing books and stories, it's kind of already predefined, right? As to, well, whatever the audience for that story is, that's our audience too. And we fit very well within that kind of ecosystem where we're trying to be a part of the traditional story time and the classic story time between parents and kids. So we want them to continue doing what they're doing, do it more often, and then just press this one button first before you start reading to make it a lot more fun.
Yeah, I think that like you have to maybe design the experiences keeping specific age groups in mind, like you mentioned in your case. How did you think about the sounds? Like, did you test the sound effects with different age groups to make sure that this sound is fitting well with this age group? Like, for example, if Disney would have done anything, like, their experience kind of caters to everyone. A 2-year-old would enjoy the same way as a 60-year-old, right? Mm-hmm. But they also have rides catering to different age groups as well. So obviously they might have done a lot of testing as well with all of these different users to understand their psychology or their mental model or what they attract to and things like that. So are those kind of things what you did when you were designing the sounds as well?
Yeah, well, honestly, like what we did as far as the audio goes was trust the professionals. I am not a sound creative, That is not my background or expertise. I'm a parent, right? And I can give feedback from that perspective. But what we did was, you know, we hired a great team. And our audio content designers are very experienced in scoring film and video games for families. And you know, they already knew what to do. They already knew kind of what resonated with different age groups. So we were able to lean a lot on their learnings. And keeping in mind, we're a startup, so we move fast and break things. And we would much rather give it out to users widely if we experiment with something or try something and let them give us their feedback rather than doing focus groups and test groups, because we're a startup. We got to move fast. We got to do our thing. And we just need to get that feedback as quickly as we can and learn from it. And we focus more on, well, how do we approach the next book differently, right? With this in mind, how do we approach the next story? Because there's a limitless supply of content.
Is your product specific for, like, for example, like for each story, you have a different subject which you are thinking about, and then thinking about all of the other things associated to it. And so there are two questions I have here. One thing is that the sound design team does all of the work, like you mentioned. But then how are you thinking about where we have to include the sounds, or where are those points where people will actually like it when there are some effects?
Yeah, well, honestly, what people tell us is they want more of it. I think one of the phrases that I heard early on that stuck with me was in for a penny, in for a pound. So embrace it, basically, as far as what you're doing. We look for every opportunity that we have within a story to make it better, right, with contextualized audio. So whether that be voiceover or sound effect or change in underlying background music or ambiance. But our content designers, everything is custom for every single book. While we may repeat like a dog bark sound between books, the sound design and composition is original for every title. And so that individual will go through, look at the book, maybe talk to the author, the publisher, get a sense of maybe what their feelings are and what they were trying to convey in some emotional context. And then they go to town, and we've done almost 700 stories now. And so they're pretty experienced at doing this at this point. And they do a book in, gosh, like 4 to 6 hours these days.
Oh, that is fascinating.
Yeah.
The process is fascinating. Everything is being considered. There's so much strategy involved, right? From selecting the story to actually adding all of the content into it, and then the effects and the sound and all of those stuff. So there's a lot of strategy involved in the entire thing. Now, let's think about use cases, right? Like when we are designing for kids, there are different use cases which people have to consider. How should one approach or select, like, these are the use cases? Nowadays, anything and everything could be voice enabled. Mm-hmm. But what are the strategies one should consider when they are designing for kids?
Yeah, I mean, I guess as far as use cases go and the strategies to select those use cases, kind of to what I was saying before about outcomes, right? It's a little bit more about, where can voice change the game here? Where can voice not just make something a little bit different, but significantly improve it, right? I think those are what interest me the most, and doing things that like you couldn't otherwise do without voice, right? That seems to be where we're looking more and more towards, because the turn your lights on, turn your lights off, play music, like, that's pretty well landscaped out. You're not going to do a whole lot different kind of in that context. But what can you do differently with voice that you couldn't do with other inputs? And how can that play a part in making our lives better, particularly for kids? That's kind of the selection methodology I think I would go through if I was deciding between kind of some new things. And then lastly, like, as any entrepreneur, you really got to have a love of what you're doing, and you really got to believe in it. And so you kind of have to have that fit on both sides, that it's a use case that makes sense, voice makes better, and for kids in particularly, it can be achievable with robust outcomes. to I have a passion for doing that, because that's what will win the day, because it's always going to be a roller coaster. And if you don't have the passion, you're never going to get back on the upswing of that roller coaster.
Yeah, definitely. I feel like everything starts from that passion, right? If you want to design something, then yeah. So yes, there is a passion people want to design, but like you mentioned, they have to consider so many different things, thinking about the strategy, thinking about the target audience, what they would like, what they would not like, their needs, to thinking about, like you mentioned, like the legalities of things as well. Now, how about the dialogues? When someone is designing, the entire part of the conversation interfaces is the dialogue system or how it responds back. So do you see conversational designers needs to taper the responses or customize the responses for kids, especially when they are designing a kid-specific skill or a feature?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, again, I'm probably not the best one to comment here because we do not use conversational design at all. That is just not what we do. But we've played with it, right? We've experimented with it. And you got to recognize that the fallibilities of the ASR, the automatic speech recognition, from the get-go. So if you're going to analyze an utterance for an intent and it's giving you the wrong words, well, your intent's going to be wrong. But how can you quote unquote game the system in order to trick it into satisfying an intent bucket? And I think one good example that I heard recently was one of these kid skills asked for the kid to say the word astronaut as a selection or an option. And they were getting a lot of rejections or negative kind of feedback on that selection from Alexa. And it kept on saying, ask me not versus astronaut, right? Because that's just what the voice system thought it said. So they went in and plugged ask me not in as an option, an alternative phrase for astronaut. And that improved the robustness of their skill or experience. So I think taking a real life system, right, that you're going to be working with in the real world and like practicing these utterances and seeing what it says and then gaming it the best you can on the back end will really help improve like the success and the outcomes at the end of the day.
I like that. I like the example which you gave, like ask me not astronaut. It happens so many times when I say something and the system will not understand. Just yesterday, we were doing this voice assistant throwdown. And I asked Siri to, I said, Siri, I want to add a couple of things to my shopping list. So technically I wanted to say, I want a list of things. Now I'll just speak them out. You add it into the shopping list. And what she said is done. And then I see in my shopping list, there was something called couple of things. So of course, if the system was smart enough to understand what I meant, and I think the systems are not yet there, it would have been a different experience. Like it would have asked, okay, tell me about those things or something, right? So anyway, so the same kind of thing, what you're saying that like, you should know how to game the system if you don't have a specific recognition or something in there. Mm-hmm. How about the dialogues itself? Like when you are speaking, like Alexa's said done. Okay, when I said add a couple of things to my shopping list, she said done. And Alexa would be like, okay, I've added a couple of things to your shopping list, right? So it gives you more confirmation per se when it is responding back. So do you see those kind of strategies also when designing, especially for kids? Like you also have two kids when they are interacting with the assistant, where that breaking point is. Do you see some of those kind of confirmations or the way it responds back kind of affects the way kids think or react?
I haven't noticed it too much with Eleanor, my daughter, so far, because she knows what she wants. And she's not asking for kind of complex things. It is play the song, right? I want to dance. I want some dance party music. So from what I've seen, it's usually when it fails, she just repeats until she gets it right. I think from a developer perspective, but again, it's looking at your results that come back, right? And really iterating. It's not just I launch it and it's done. It is I have to keep iterating and optimizing and looking at, well, it failed here. Why? And can I improve it? And always looking at that is really what's going to help you kind of learn. Because I think it's all very unique, right, to your particular skill and context as to what the right outcome is. And recognizing that well, you're going to have to teach Alexa from a developer perspective, right? And she'll get smarter over time if you keep teaching her, right? And so I think that is really what you have to do at this stage of the game is be very particular about your failures and why they happen and continually improve upon them.
Yeah, that's so important. I think like everything boils down to data and analytics and constant improvement.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. So we are approaching our time. So I wanted to, ask you, like, what would you suggest any aspiring conversational designers or designers thinking about designing for kids? What are the things they should be considering? Any suggestions?
Yeah, for me, first and foremost, like what we were talking about earlier in this talk was really understanding like what you want out of this at the end of the day, right? And being intentional about your design. I think it matters for us as a society that we are using these experiences correctly and that we are training for the right things. Engagement as far as time is not the only metric. Right. And in fact, it probably is one of the least important metrics, like what satisfaction at the end of the day is really what matters, both from the kid's perspective and from the parent's perspective. So I think not losing sight of that, right, from the data and really recognizing there are people right on the other end at the end of the day. And then from a technical perspective, it's analyze your failures. It's recognize that, hey, kids don't know complex words. You need to use very direct words. If you're giving options, not too many of them, like do two. It's totally fine. The kid will have just as much fun versus three and they'll remember the choices. And then I would also tell a lot of aspiring kind of conversational designers to look out for the visual medium as well, that it's not just going to be audio only. Coming up, we've got some really cool things we're working on in voice interactive television and video, and the smart displays, the Echo shows. These things are only going to continue and going to get better. And there's a completely different thought process when you do have kind of a visual medium to support the auditory medium in these experiences and designs. And I think there's a wealth of opportunity kind of into that space. And so just think about that as you are picking and choosing what it is that you want to focus on as a new conversational designer.
Cool. These are all great points. Thank you so much, Matt. Where can users find more about you?
Yeah, check out our website, noveleffect.com. And our app is free to download on iOS and Android devices. So feel free to just search Novel Effect in either of those stores and give it a shot and read a story with a kid in your life.
Awesome. We'll make sure we add it into the show notes. Thank you so much, Matt. It was a pleasure talking to you today.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate being here.
Thanks for listening today. If you would like to post a voice comment, please go to www.witlingo.com/DAA. That's www.witlingo.com/DAA. We'd love to hear from you. Remember, you can find all the information on becoming a certified voice interaction designer and show notes and more at our website at digitalassistant.academy. That's digitalassistant.academy. We encourage your feedback and questions. Be sure to get in touch by using the Digital Assistant Academy's website. We will include the show notes link. In our next episode, Ryan Elza speaks with us about voice design strategy for the elderly population. Until next week, take care.